We talked about the absence of much serious thought, at least in recent years, maybe even recent decades, maybe recent centuries, of a theology of creation, and how at least some of us feel, and I certainly do, that we are impoverished in our whole understanding of God, and indeed even of also of redemption, if we don't have a good understanding of a theology of creation. We're talking about ways of going at that. We talked about how possibly in the past we got to where we are, where our emphasis was only on, as we talk about the three articles of the creed, that the emphasis got to be overbearing on just the second article, so that we almost became mono-creedal rather than the triune God of the Creator, as well as the Holy Spirit, as well as Jesus the Christ. And so we just tried to get at what the background of that. I listed some of the things that I thought we were impoverished by because of that, and then we had some discussion about it. Today I'd just like to read some things to you from a variety of people who are working at trying to bring creation back into focus for Christian thought. Or to say it another way, nature. Creation includes nature and creation both, I suppose, include so many things, it's hard to be very precise and accurate. But I guess I really mean, when I say nature, everything that is other than the human beings that God created. And it certainly includes the plants, the animals, the mountains, the trees, the rocks, whatever it is, including processes that are going on, including the cosmos as well. I'm not trying to limit that. A lot of the illustrations will be directly from nature, the earth that we see too, but often also as a symbol, not only for its own sake. The people I listed on the board are the ones that I'm going to be quoting from. Wendell Berry, who has written a number of books, including The Unsettling of America. Berry is a farmer from where? Kentucky. It reminds me of Hofer that Leo told about last night. This may not even be true, but it impresses me that it's sort of an average kind of a person walking along with an average education, except when he sits down to write, it turns out to be marvelous. And that was true, I thought, of Eric Hofer too. I don't know how many times I taught Hofer's books in various places. And Wendell Berry has done that too. In fact, I'll be leading off with him. Joseph Sittler, we referred to yesterday, a Lutheran, now a distinguished professor at Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago. I was delighted to have a couple of hours sitting with him a week ago last Friday when I was in Chicago. And then Matthew Fox, a Roman Catholic, he'll be quoting also from Meister Eckhart and from the historical writings. And then Paul Santmeier, another Lutheran, who lives on the East Coast and one of the few current writers. Joseph Sittler has not written much, and Santmeier has written more in the field of a creation theology. And finally, Dorothy Sole is a Roman Catholic theologian, and I'll be quoting from her too. The point is try to give you an experience of what it sounds like when people are paying attention to nature as well as redemption motif in the scriptures. And Barry's stuff isn't very religious overtly, except I think if you do any thinking about it, it turns out that'd be. And let me start by just saying some of the, I think, funny things that he writes too. He has a number of books out. These are some short writings of his, little poems, little lines. He has a couple of two-liners that I like very much. For instance, one is entitled Now. He writes, I used to wish for a breakthrough. Now I worry about what into. I like that. And Confession, two-liner again. I wish I was easy in my mind, but I ain't. If it wasn't for anger, lust, and pride, I'd be a saint. And another one titled, Walking on the River Ice. A man could be a god if the ice wouldn't melt, and if he could stand the cold, Let's see. Another one here. Oh, throwing away the mail. This is one of my favorites. If you've ever seen my desk, you can understand why I think this is my favorite. Nothing is simple, not even simplification. Thus, throwing away the mail, I exchange the complexity of duty for the simplicity of guilt. I love it. Dear. Well, then here's one that gets a little closer to the earth and his feelings. 8 Below 0 is the title. 8 Below 0 on the 5th of March. Maybe the world is coming to an end. Well, good riddance anyhow to part of it. And 42.
Who's that author?
Wendell Berry, Berry. A warning to my readers. Do not think me gentle because I speak in praise of gentleness, or elegant because I honor the grace that keeps this world. I am a man crude as any, gross of speech, intolerant, stubborn, angry, full of fits and furies. That I may have spoken well at times is not natural. A wonder is what it is. That's nice. Then the last one, which gets closer to the earth. A purification. Here's getting closer to where I think the insights from nature is closer to us. Yeah. At start of spring, I open a trench in the ground. I put into it the winter's accumulation of paper. Pages I do not want to read again. Useless words, fragments, errors. And I put into it the contents of the outhouse. Light of the sun, growth of the ground, finished with one of their journeys. To the sky, to the wind then, and to the faithful trees, I confess my sins. That I have not been happy enough, considering my good luck. Have listened to too much noise, have been inattentive to wonders, have lusted after praise. And then upon the gathered refuse of mind and body, I close the trench, folding shut again the dark, the deathless earth. Beneath that seal, the old escapes into the new. I like that. Yesterday I was fidgeting around here with this paper by Dr. Sittler that I had referred to that had been written in 1961, entitled A Call to Unity. I gave it back on my own hook a subtitle of Redemption Within Creation, because that's a line in one of here. And Joe was kind enough to accept that. This has been reprinted by Holden not too long ago. It's a rather erudite piece of writing. It was done for the World Council of Churches assembly in New Delhi in 1961, and all of the, quote, theologians of the world, everything was there, and this little 12-page thing knocked the socks off of most of them at the time, and I think it's made his name and reputation as a creative thinker way back in those days, which he certainly still is today. But I want to just read some things from him to see what he's getting at, and if these aren't clear, maybe we can even talk about them. He talks about this Colossians 1 passage that we read yesterday about all things being together in Christ. We must not fail to see the nature and size of the issue that Paul confronts and encloses in this vast Christology, this teaching about Jesus Christ. In propositional form, it is simply this: a doctrine of redemption is meaningful only when it swings within the larger orbit of a doctrine of creation. For God's creation of earth cannot be redeemed in any intelligible sense of the word apart from a doctrine of the cosmos, which is God's home, God's definite place, the theater of God's selfhood, the incorporation with God's neighbor, and in a caring relationship with nature, God's sister. And then he quotes from a fellow named Galloway. Unless one is prepared to accept a dualism which condemns the whole physical order as being not of God, and interprets redemption simply as release from the physical order, then one is forced to raise the question of cosmic redemption, not in contrast with, but as an implication of personal redemption. Physical nature cannot be treated as an indifferent factor, as the mere stage and setting of the drama of personal redemption. It must either be condemned as in itself evil, or else it must be brought within the scope of God's redemptive act. So in the effort yesterday that we were certainly talking about a number of times, not to go into a theology of creation that is instead of the relationship to God in Jesus Christ through his redemptive acts, not to do that, how to keep them together. In essence, Sittler is asking for a Christology, an understanding of the life, death, and resurrection, and continuing presence of Jesus Christ that is big enough to include all of nature and of creation. And his reason for doing that, the matter might be put another way, he writes. The address of Christian thought is most weak, precisely where human ache is most strong. We have had and have a Christology of the moral soul, a Christology of history, affirmations so huge as to fill the sphere, to fill the space marked out by ontological questions, questions about what it means to be and be alive. But we do not have, at least not in such effective force as to have engaged the thought of the common life, generally, people talking about it. We do not have a daring, penetrating, life-affirming Christology of nature. The theological magnificence of cosmic Christology lies, for the most part, still tightly folded in the church's innermost heart and memory. In other words, he thinks it's there, but it hasn't been opened up so that we can include it. When he talks about the questions being asked, I think that relates to what the things we talked about yesterday. If people are trying to understand, well, what does all this technological development mean? What does this mean that so many drugs can do these things and those things? All of that's of nature. What does it mean that we're able to flip off into the moon or wherever else it may be? Is that good or bad? What does it mean that we can devote so much time, effort, money, and will to the development of destructive forces unknown before? All of those aches, those questions, those haunts that, whether we know it or not, often third, fourth, and fifth graders are thinking about and worrying about, as well as, I think, the rest of the population, that those aches and questions are to be answered, says Sittler, by a Christology, an understanding of the life and love of Jesus Christ that is rooted in the creation, which is connected with all those forces and decisions that are being made, that are changing our world so drastically. My crass example yesterday was that possibility of education by laser that would give you not only understanding and information, but it would even give you attitudes and feelings. And my contention is that people are already working on that. I can't prove that, but I don't have any doubt about it. And Sittler was crying 25 years ago and more, and still today, for a broad enough understanding of Jesus Christ that the creation isn't left out or shunted aside or made unimportant or made secondary to the understanding of God, the whole understanding of God, as we as Christians have come to know that understanding in Jesus Christ and through the power of the Spirit. Okay?
May I say one
sure.
thing? Dr. Sittler was here at Holden.
Yes, he was.
1977, I believe, for mm-hmm. the pastoral conference. Mm-hmm. And there's an excellent tape in the library called The Cosmic Christ.
Good. I didn't know that, but I'd forgotten it. That's good. Thank you for calling attention to it. Marvelous speaker. He's really a literature prof. And what a big advantage. He just has all kinds of literary information at his fingertips. And now he's blind. I had to get him into his chair when I was with him a week ago. But now he calls back hundreds, literally hundreds of poems. Good stuff from memory. And when he speaks, there's almost always good quotation from some of the best of the poetry in the English language for Joe to use and share. He came to visit my wife a number of times while she was dying. They got to be good friends. She started out, she wanted to know about all this evil business and what he thought about it, where that all fit into God's cosmos. He was just great in his sharing of all the marvelous things that he had shared with her, and got her reading poetry in a way that she had never done it before. It was a marvelous gift that Joe gave to her. Good man. His wife is seriously ill. He's hoping that she'll heal last long enough to take care of her, because she's bedridden and doesn't recognize anybody anymore. I sat with her for about a half hour. She could not recognize me anymore. Good man. Well, Matthew Fox. This book by Original Blessing is one of many books that Fox has written. That were his original writings were mostly about what it means to be a spiritual being, coming out of his background as a... I always want to call him a Benedictine, but I don't think he is. Dominican. He's a Dominican. Scholar. Now located down in the Oakland area. He was formerly in Chicago. This book, Original Blessing, is, as I indicated yesterday, as a contrast to Original Sin. Not to do away with Original Sin, but to start at a different point. And his suggestion is that a theology of creation enables us to start at a different point and include also original sin and whatever else would be related to redemption. I've written a little review of this book for the Holden Resource Packet, and there are a number of things that I don't like about the book. I think it's poorly written, for one thing. A good editor would have made it a great book, but somehow that didn't happen. I don't think it's clearly written, and I'm accepting of not having to be a classical authored in order to do that. And he uses hyperbole a lot, meaning that he says much more than is really true in order to get less across. And in other words, he traces all the ills of the world, and probably including your toenail hurting last night, back to something that he saw go wrong. And that's a little much. And there are a number of places where he could have held back, but it's probably it's probably what happens when anybody tries to do something new. They have to go way over here in order to get something here. But if you recognize that in here and sort of say, okay, I'm going to put up with hyperbole, then you might get something out of the book. And I, having said that, and there's some other things I didn't care for. I think there's some good ideas in the book and things that are very much worth talking about. Let me tell you quickly what he does in the book. He suggests four pathways or four paths to work at having a creation-centered spirituality. Let me give you the four titles. Path one is befriending creation. And then he gives it a Latin name, the via positiva, the positive way, an emphasis on positive, or blessing rather than starting with sin. And then under that he has 10 themes, all individually developed under that first path. The second path is befriending darkness. This is where he deals with sin and all that goes wrong in life, evil, whatever it may be. Letting go and letting be, he calls it, the via negativa, dealing with the negative dimension, the dark side, if you will. The first one he relates to a theology of creation and incarnation. The second one he relates to a theology of the cross, so that it has to be rooted in the cross of Christ. The third path is befriending creativity, and that's the via creativa, the creative way. And then he has six themes under that. And finally, he has the fourth path, befriending new creation. And that's where he deals with compassion, celebration, and justice. He calls that the via transformativa, the transforming way. And then he has six themes under that that he develops. I thought what I'd do is I'd read from a number of these themes and just give you a feel for what Fox is trying to do from letting you hear him a bit. It is as I implied, it's not an easy book just to plow through. I think I've read it 6 or 7 times now, and because I've taught a couple of courses on it. But without reading it that often, I don't think you would really be able to get a lot out of it. It just, and because that has to do with the fact that a lot of it is new, and there's a lot of references to the past, a lot of historical references, especially to Christian mystics, which many of us have not been in touch with a lot, and then also because of the way it's put together. Well, let me see some things on page 46. We'll start. If this be the case, he starts, namely that original blessing is behind all that is. That's where he starts in this first chapter, the via positiva. What about the famous doctrine of original sin? Then he goes on and reads about that. There's a genuine scandal involved in this dangerous distortion of life and biblical data. And he felt that a one-sided emphasis on fallen redemption theology twisted even the redemption theology. The scandal is one of ignoring and then even despising creation and those who love creation, for instance, such as Native American peoples or matriarchal religions. Even if original sin is to be taken literally, which later on he agrees with, still the facts are as follows, that if we take the universe to be about 20 billion years old, as scientists are advising us to do, then sin of the human variety is about 4 million years old, since that's how long humans have been around. But creation is 19,996,000,000 years older. So fall redemption theology has ignored the blessing that creation is because of its anthropomorphic preoccupation with sin. The result has been, among other things, the loss of the pleasure from spirituality, and with this loss, the increase of pain, of injustice, of sadomasochism and distrust. 19 billion years before there was any sin on earth, there was blessing. This one, yes, for not to be talking during this time, okay? The next section from Fox 52. Here's where some direct implications come for what a creation-based spirituality might be like. Let's see. Be sure and get started at the right place. If creation is a blessing and a constantly original one, then our proper response would be to enjoy. Pleasure is one of the deepest spiritual experiences in our lives. Ecstasy is the experience of God. And he refers to where he wrote about that before. But pleasure does not come easily to a society inundated by consumer consciousness on the one hand, and by mentalities overdrawn on sin on the other hand. Ashley Montague defines pleasure as what we are pleased to do. Pleasure truly pleases and does not merely titillate. He's not talking about just getting a little kick out of something. Today, the true contemplative will teach us what it means to contemple once again. That is, to become so thoroughly one with what we love and enjoy that we make a holy tabernacle of the event. The true contemplativist will teach us the art of savoring. I like this section. The art of savoring. For creation needs savoring much more than it needs inventory making. And he contrasts some of the people. There's a story of some people arriving on our shores back whenever the discoveries of America was being made, and instead of just simply drinking in all the stuff that was there and smelling it and enjoying it, they made an inventory of it and made a list of it so they could take it back. And he was saying that missed all that was there. And so the art of savoring, he thinks, is what we need. He says, if we savored more, we would buy less. We would be less compulsive, less unsatisfied. We'd also work less and play more, and thus open up work opportunities to many unemployed and underemployed in our culture. If we savored more, we would communicate more deeply, relate more fully, compete less regularly, and celebrate more authentically. We would be relating more deeply to ourselves, to creation and all its blessedness, to history past and to future, to the now, and of course to God. We would be more in touch with our moral outrage because our love of life would increase so dramatically that we would become less and less tolerant of death forces. And by that he finds out later on he means illness and evil as well as war, whatever. The source of all authentic pleasure is God, and anyone who has taken time to savor the blessings of life knows that they are profoundly, deliciously, deeply sweet, and naturally so. Then he points out that often any sense of pleasure in history of the church was often a sign that it was evil. If it brought you pleasure, there was something wrong with it, rather than delighting in it. He goes on, the constantly used word in wisdom literature, in Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, is the word delight. That word is replaced in one's unconsciousness by that word that's so often cheaply invoked by non-creation-centered spiritualists of sin. So the moderate employment of pleasure, if referred to its end, is not an evil. He goes on to say that it is grand. Our calling requires us to return pleasure for pleasure. The pleasures that we have received to be about the people giving pleasure as well. Related to that, he does some stuff in another paragraph about fertility. A theology of blessing is a theology about a different kind of power. He talks about how power gets in the way. Not the power of control or the power of being over or being under, but the power of fertility. Blessing is fertility to the people of Israel and to the Native American, to other pre-patriarchal religions. This ongoing and fructifying dimension to the Dabar, creative energy of God, is captured by the prophet Isaiah. He says, yes, as the rain and the snow come down from the heavens, and do not return without watering the earth, making it yield and giving growth to provide seed for the sower and bread for the eating, so the word that goes through my mouth does not return to me empty, without carrying out my will and succeeding in what it was sent to do. Just how fertile is creation and the creation's imagination in making it so? Annie Dillard marvels at the extravagance of nature's ways. As an example, she gives, a single rye plant in 4 months can grow 370 miles of root, 14 billion root hairs, and in 1 cubic inch of soil, the length of these root hairs would total 6,000 miles. Then she adds, now that's fertility. And so that understanding and the acceptance and blessing of what God, of the abundance of God, the fertility of what the creation, the nature God has given us. And a different score, and later in the book, Fox talks about another dimension. The salvation that Jesus brings is primarily liberation from the fear of death. The author of the book of Hebrews puts it this way: Jesus, by his death, took away all the power of the devil, who had power over death, and set free all those who had been held in slavery all their lives by the fear of death. When Otto Rank says that Jesus and Paul brought the greatest social revolution the world has seen, he is responding to the same good news that Hebrews speaks about: to free all those held in slavery by fear of death is to free all. For according to Rank, the human preoccupation with immortality, with escaping mortality, grounds all human fears from the fear to create to the fear to let go. Fear of death is the cause of so much sin. Power over others, thus sadism. Fear of eros and of living, thus sins against the via positiva. Consumerism, hoarding. Jesus' liberation, then, is of the most radical and the most universal kind. Were we truly to enter into its depths, we would cease our questing for pyramids of immortality and money, fame, power, militarism. We would cease the sexism and racism by which we need to project our death fears, and we would become the images of God, the birthing, creative, co-creators we were all meant to be. Truly, there is good news wrought by the cross of Jesus Christ in all of this. As Paul put it, the doctrine of the cross is the power of God. He states that the kingdom would come only by letting go. That is, like a seed, it must first die darkly in the black soil underground. And then he talks about the transfiguration being a comparable thing to that. So the whole dealing with death, he says, is rooted in a broader understanding of what the resurrection, what the death of Christ and the resurrection of Christ means, not only to us as individuals, but to the whole creation as well, is what he's trying to say in this part. He goes a little further in page 281. The reason the pornography industry has priority on the word erotic is that our spiritual traditions in the West have lost passion for passion and lost passion for eros. Spiritual persons need to redeem the word erotic before it is too late. And he says, this is what the black feminist poet Audre Lorde, whom I don't know, does in a brilliant and beautiful article called The Uses of the Erotic as Power. She points out that what distinguishes the erotic from the pornographic is that true love includes feeling and not just sensation. To recover the erotic is to recover feeling. But in a patriarchal society, I'm quoting her, the erotic becomes misnamed by men. And our economic systems themselves divorce us from feeling because it defines the good in terms of profit rather than terms of human need. I don't know if you do it. I do it all the time. That's why I'm sort of glad to be away from television. I always argue with the ads. If somebody tells me I'm going to be better off by buying your product, I say, I am not. Not. That's a bunch of malarkey. That used to irritate my wife quite a bit. But, this idea that they make profit, I'm going to be better off, is not really what I'm willing to buy. Human need is about feelings. Feelings of our self-worth, of our cosmic interconnectedness, of our emptiness and pain, of our power to give birth and to be instruments of change and transformation. Lorde points out that a culture cut off from an erotic base, you know, so that does not mean pornographic or oversexed or something like that, but a base that deals with the passion that we are given, robs our work of its erotic value and its erotic power and life appeal and fulfillment. She sees the erotic as integral to the via creativa, which surely it is, says Fox. Erotically satisfying experiences can include dancing, building a bookcase, writing a poem, examining an idea. We've associated almost all with genital activities of some kind. And he's saying there's so much more. A feminist spirituality, as distinct from a patriarchal one, will value the erotic and teach us disciplines of erotic, celebrating, creating, and justice making. When I speak of the erotic, he quotes the Lord for the last time, then I speak of it as an assertion of the life force of women. And he indicates here that's a gift that women have been enabled and called upon to give to the whole creation. And then finally on page 283, a related matter. The God of this tradition is not an unmoved mover, a perfectly in control person in the sky. Rather, as we saw in theme 2 and elsewhere, the Creator God is a God who delights, who truly participates, who urges us to develop the art of savoring. Meister Eckhart says that this God, who is voluptuous and delicious, and the maker of all that is voluptuous and delicious, dances and becomes tickled with joy. This God is a very youthful God, for when we say God is eternal, we mean God is eternally young. Mechtel sings of this same theme, how God is our divine playmate who calls out the child in each of us. We read in wisdom literature about the play of God, and we've considered the play of God as artist in the previous chapter. Artist, child, and eros go together. And if our God is artist and child, then truly our God is an erotic God. Does not God the mother play? What kind of mother would it be who never played with her babies? Does not God the lover play? What kind of lovers would they be who did not play together? Surely the Song of Songs of Solomon celebrates the holy playfulness of lovers. This erotic and sacred book, because of the sacredness of erotic play, is not compelled to name God even once. Is there a musician who does not play with piano keys, the notes, the counterpoint, the harmonies? Is there a thinker who does not play with ideas? As the psalmist asks the question, does the maker of ears not hear? So we need to ask the question, does the maker of play not play? Does the maker of eros not join in the erotic? So a broader, deeper understanding of the relationship to God is what Fox is about in his four pathways. Quickly, something from Paul Centmar, and then I want to share with Dorothy Sorrell. Towards the end, Paul writes a new approach to looking at the readings of the Scripture. I won't read much from his. In a different way. It's possible to construe those historical categories more generously. He thinks not only was it all seen as history rather than also as nature, seen as thought or idea rather than also as place. He makes a big point out of Brigham's book on the land, that the Old Testament had to do with the land, that God's grace was given through the land. And when they were landless, they were cut off from God. Goes into a lot of stuff, I suppose, about the whole business of Zionism today as well. So he says they were so narrow in that they missed part of the revelation of God. So not in terms of God and humanity over against nature, is what he's calling for, but in terms of God and humanity with nature, so that the triangle would be God, humanity, and nature. Would be the triangle that he would be espousing. Here's where he picks up a lot about the land. The land for Deuteronomy, above all, is regarded as a gift. It does not belong to Israel. It is not Israel's property. Yahweh alone provides the land of promise. The land is mine, and you are but aliens who have become my tenants. And that's in Leviticus. Israel cannot and does not and need not secure its existence for itself. It is done for it by the same one who gave manna, quail, and water. Only now the gifts are enduring and not so precarious. Indeed, this is the most gifted land. So remember yesterday we talked about moving towards a promised land as a motif. If that's a way that we also look at scriptures, not exclusively, but that we also read the stories of the Bible as being in the context of seeking a better land, a specific piece of land where nature, creation, is celebrated and enjoyed. That gives an added dimension, is what Centmar does in these last chapters. And especially at the end, where he talks about the future of nature. If the final aim of God in his governance of all things is to bring into being at the very end a glorified kingdom of spirits alone, who thus united with God may contemplate him in perfect bliss, while as a precondition of their ecstasy, all the other creatures of nature must be left by God to fall away into eternal oblivion. That's one future. On the other hand, is the final aim of God in his governance of all things to communicate his life to another in a way which calls forth at the very end new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells, a transfigured cosmos where peace is universally established between all creatures at last, in the midst of which is situated a glorious city of resurrected saints who dwell in justice, blessed with all the resplendent fullness of the earth, and who continually call upon all creatures to join with them in their joyful praise of the one who is all in all. With the question posed this way, he says, a large majority of modern biblical scholars would self-consciously choose the first option, in keeping with their interpretive assumptions. Our review of classical Christian thought, this is his last paragraph, about nature, highlights a fresh interpretive possibility, an ecology reading of biblical faith. If contemporary Christian theologians took that kind of approach seriously, instructed along the way by teachers such as Irenaeus, Augustine, and Francis, that could lead to a new birth of Christian thought about nature. And the travail of nature in Christian theology could come to be a blessed ending. That's from Santmeyer. And then Dorothy Sullivan. She's the most radical of the ones that have written on this, probably because she's a feminist. I mean, and that's not to put her down. It just means, I think that's how it comes out. Let me see what it means for her. First of all, Christianity adopted the Israelite version of creation, in which God is distinct from the world, and human beings are not set in hierarchical relationship with one another. It is precisely at this juncture, however, where Christianity emphasized the distinctiveness and separateness of God from the world and humanity from the earth, that our scrutiny and questioning of the Christian tradition must begin. She goes on to point out that distancing of God led to an understanding of God as being absolutely transcendent. Separateness as a quality of divinity became extolled as a virtue in and of itself. The independence of God was understood as intrinsic to divinity, and unrelatedness was considered a sign of God's greatness and glory. Her contention is, and I'm skipping through here, is that absolute transcendence literally means unrelatedness, and he feels what is needed is for us to understand the importance and essential need of relatedness, that not only we have to be related to God, but that God has to be related to us. Maybe some of you have already, I'm sure some of you have heard James Weldon Johnson's poem about creation. God stepped out on space. She has just quotes from it here. I don't have all of it. And God stepped out on space and looked around and said, I'm lonely. I'll make me a world. As far as the eye could see, eye of God could see, darkness covered everything, blacker than 100 midnights down in a cypress swamp. And then God smiled, and the light broke. The darkness rolled up on one side, and the light stood shining on the other, and God said, that's good. And then God reached out and took the light in his hands, and God rolled the light around in his hands until he made the sun, and he set that sun ablazing in the heavens. And then God walked around, and God looked around on all he had made. This is at the end. He looked at his sun, he looked at his moon, he looked at his little stars, and he looked on at the world with all the living things, and God said, I'm lonely still. Then God sat down on the side of the hill where he could think. By a deep, wide river, he sat down. With his head in his hands, God thought and thought until he thought, I'm going to make me a human being. So that connection of that need of God, the distinctiveness of God in being all in all and everything and source and beginning, not to be taken away, but also added to that, that connectedness between God and the creation, indeed between God and people, is what she is emphasizing there. And she sees that as the otherness of the problems that they're trying to deal with is the otherness of God, making God that far away without being related. The godless matter that brings out, that then all the stuff of the earth becomes godless, and then also human loneliness is part of that, and seeks a creation-centered theology to make that connectedness with God, to have matter be also connected with God, and to have human loneliness worked out in relationship to God and to the nature that is around us. Okay? 25, she's got a nice line there, I like it. She talks about process theology. Process thought shares with Buber the belief that just as relationship is not accidental to God, so too the world is not accidental. Reality consists of interrelated processes, events, occasions of experience. And so she said that's what enables us to then be related to God, because that relationship is essential. God's relationship to the world is essential. Our relationship to that world is essential too. God is always greater than God at is. God is always greater than God is at any given moment because of God's potentiality. It continues and goes on and on. Anytime we think we've got it packaged or figured out or whatever else, we're limiting God, and the old book that was written, Your God is Too Small, comes into effect. Another implication of creation-centered theology, she says you have to recognize that you come from dust. What does our being made from dust mean? My free associations form a kind of meditation. I am limited in time, in space, in strength, in power. I am frail, perishable, decaying. I am bound by biology. I have only limited choices, choices conditioned by my life in my body. And she goes on to say, can I affirm myself as one who is made from dust? And then goes on to study the meaning of being created in God's image as it relates to those limitations, but an acceptance of those limitations as well. Couple more. When she talks about the otherness of God, she tries to give other possibilities. God is infinite distance on the one hand, and also is seen in mystical union with us, as we say even in the Eucharist, that God who is so far off, up in the heavens doing everything, is suddenly, we say, take and eat. This is my body. The connection is there. And so, not saying one or the other, she's saying to affirm both. So the God within us, the birth of God in our soul, the God who is connected to our inner being, as we talk about it, for instance, in Holy Baptism. She talks about the empowerment by God. She gives some new names for God. All things are possible. If God's name is also all is possible, if that's another way of talking about God, that might be a way of expanding our understanding. And she does the same thing in terms of our ability to wonder and our ability to preserve beauty. And the last part deals with the need for joy. In the Jewish tradition, joy was understood as the most natural response to our having been created, while sadness was deemed a rejection of the gift of life. In this metaphysical sense, joy is not derived from special events or the presents we receive. It involves the mere delight in being alive and the gratefulness for the gift of life. People grow up in this culture most of the time without any education for joy. Does the deep, reasonless joy of being alive die in a world without religion? Does it make a difference with regard to our capacity to enjoyment whether we live in a world we think is made by human beings or in one we believe to be created by God? It's a remarkable absence of joy in secular, industrialized cultures. And that's one of the critiques we would make of other societies, and very likely of our own. At the same time, my spiritual experience teaches me that to recall creation, to be reminded of our createdness in a community of people who struggle together, enhances my awareness of joy, of how much I need it, of how much I yearn for it. A spirituality of creation reminds us that we were born for joy. Well, those are examples from the writings of various people of directions that they would go if they were caught up more in a theology of creation that emphasizes the gift and the blessing that is given to us in a creation that is also tainted as we are, of course, but that is still part of God's gift to us. Maybe you have responses or that I did a lot of reading to you, or questions or ideas. Yeah?
Wouldn't Thoreau be also?
Indeed, Fox quotes from Thoreau a number of times. Correct. Right.
It's kind of simplistic. I was going to say.
Sure.
I was sometimes think of having God being, you know, everywhere at once and doing all kinds. I realize this is really simplistic, but
I don't know. Can everybody hear you?
No.
Can you all hear?
All
they
right,
can't
I'm
hear
sorry.
You.
Sometimes I think of how can God be everywhere and a lot of things at one time, and maybe me. But then I just thought of sunlight or sunshine. I wonder if that's a, you know, like the sun has this tremendous power. Not that I'm going to go worship the sun exactly, but just that there's this tremendous power and the possibility of it being everywhere, or, you know, spread throughout.
Well, I think that's an example of the inclusiveness and penetratingness of God. It even says, as the sun shines on the good and on the ungood, the just, the unjust,
right.
And all of that God's gift is given that way. I think that's a symbol, a sign of God's, certainly of God's power and God's will. Well, that's amazing. Somebody else? Yes.
Fox, in an earlier book entitled Compassion, contrasts the worship up
yes.
that we got from climbing Jacob's ladder with the dancing Sarah's circle,
right.
which I like very much in the roundness and the inclusiveness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the misunderstanding of Jacob's ladder that we have worked with, that it was a way to get up to heaven, but rather in Jacob's story, the angels are coming up and down to us. You know, it's really the other way around totally. But he takes that idea of using the ladder of making our way up. Remember, we were talking yesterday about the ascent motif, that if we bought into that, in contrast to our being set upon the earth, God's gift of creation, and dancing in it, in a circle, which he said is a symbol for our togetherness together. And he makes a great attempt.
That's
I think very
celebration
useful.
Celebration of the human,
right.
than the dancing Christ.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a good illustration. That's a good book too, by the way, Compassion.
I like it.
Right. Yeah, I think so too. I think it's better. This was a better effort, but I don't think it worked as well. Yeah.
I've certainly enjoyed your presentation, and I think there's very much to take home and think over. And of course, we have to put this through the filter of our own minds now and hearts.
True.
And I do believe that there are some points there that we might question the premises, like, for instance, in Fox's writing about the length of time up until man was created,
sure.
to make a point that Earth deserves that much of our consideration because of the length of time. And when you toss billions or millions around, there's one of these questions that arise as far as our Christian understanding goes. But I do believe that the enjoyment factor that you've emphasized comes out if you're ministering to an ailing, aged saint. And as you do, you know, you ask, well, how are you feeling? And of course, that's one of those open-ended questions, but that's a good way to start a conversation. And instead of hearing, well, I'm 98% feeling lousy, if that person says, as has frequently been said to me, I'm feeling a little bit well, instead of I feel lousy, you get the positive side of this enjoyment, or the fact that the Lord has given us this amount of time, we're in the world, and we don't need everything to buy, you know, every day out of the store, as you emphasize. So we are feeling a little bit well.
Sure. That's really neat. Neat phrase. Yes?
I haven't heard you mention this, but that banner over there,
oh, yes,
I think has everything to do with it.
Go ahead.
Well, no, you know the story better than I do. I haven't heard it in a while.
That's a banner done by Dan Erlander, formerly on our staff here, and now a university pastor at Pacific Lutheran. It grows out of his connection with the Indians, the Native Americans in New Mexico. I've forgotten which are down there. But it's the focus on, he's obviously much better at doing this than I am, the center of the cross on Jesus Christ. And the four dots, he said, he just needed something there. So they don't mean anything. And the light going out from the center of the cross is the light of creation, the sun, sustaining the sun and everything else. That sustains the creation. And then there's our four trees in the corners, and then of the around the yellow. And then in the four corners are the four fire, wind, water, and what? Earth? Whatever the four are, I always get mixed up. And then the animals and the people around the edge who are all also sustained by all of this. And this was a banner that he did for our theme, One Lord, Many Members. So it was the membership of the whole of creation in our relationship to God in Christ. And that's the cover in just one color that was on the front of the book that's Joseph Sittler that we reprinted. They took that symbol and put it on there. Thanks, Douglas. I forgot about that. Yes?
Would this not be just a little bit opposite, though, to the original method used by the missionaries or the Lutheran pastors out here to convey salvation to the illiterates, say, we call it in the best sense of the word, the Indians and the folks in Michigan or Father Lutheran up in there? One glance at the shepherd, Jesus the shepherd and the sheep following, would put a message across of salvation. It took about 3 minutes here to explain this banner to me. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I'd have probably stood at it and wondered and looked at it, and I could see what perhaps the man was trying to say. But to me, this is a complex story. The shepherd and the sheep, Jesus and the staff. It was the simplest, without even knowing the language, you got a message across to these people. So maybe we've covered from simplicity on up to complexity here.
Except they wouldn't get a whole story out of the story of the shepherd. You know, and they could get a wrong story out of the shepherd, too. Depends on what you said with it. If you just put that picture up there, it could be just somebody taking care of sheep for a Native American.
Perhaps.
Yeah. Well, you'd have to say something. You know, who is that? What's he doing? And what's the relationship? You know, it certainly wouldn't stand by itself. You and I bring all the ideas to it. But if you were cold turkey seeing a picture of a shepherd and a sheep, you wouldn't get Jesus Christ out of
that.
You'd have to say something.
Well, in Frankenmuth in St. Lorenz Church is a, as you know,
I've seen it. I've been
seen there. But it was my understanding that that was what was used to, with very few words, to tell the story.
I'm suspicious of those histories then, because I don't think there's very few words that would get that across. I think it'd have to be quite a few words with it too. And I'm sure, I'm agreeing with you, that's simple, this is complex. I'm not arguing that at all, for sure.
That's right.
But there are beautiful ways of doing it. But that include more of the creation itself being part of God's concern. That's what he was trying to get at here. And, you know, and the other would just say, well, Jesus loves you and takes care of you, that's fine. But he also loves and takes care of that whole creation that's involved in it. That's what Dan was over after here, and that's the thing we've been talking about. There are good ways of communicating simply the information about God's love in Jesus Christ. And we don't have to make that complex. And adding to that, the creation part doesn't have to be complex too. I'm giving you different ways of people doing it. But I think we also, it fights its way through because we have so many encased ways of doing it. I was trained in a certain way to say only certain words about Jesus Christ, and those words are only part of hundreds of ways the Bible talks about Jesus Christ, and I had to fight my way out to be able to talk about more ways than the ones that I was taught. And I think that's some of the stuff we have to overcome. I'm talking about us as Christians now, not the new to the faith. Sure. Yes.
I'd like to say that Dan expressed a real good understanding of Indians when he symbolized this way, because they're masters at symbolism. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
and they did recognize creation and God and nature.
Well, they surely did.
And they would recognize this. They'd probably be able to interpret it far better than we would.
Far better than I would. I know that. Because we've had them here, and they were much more at home with this.
And of course, in Indian language, there is no word for religion, because everything is sacred.
That's right. Yeah, that's why if you notice one of our... Part of our offering this year is going to the contribution of the dialogue going on between Christian leaders and Native American religious leaders, and that's not a fair word for them, for that continual meeting and understanding one another better, because we believe we have something to bring and offer, and at the same time we think that they have understandings that we might grow from in an understanding as well.